Jazz pianist composer Horace Silver with Michael Brecker on tenor sax, Ronnie Cuber on baritone, Claudio Roditi on trumpet and flugelhorn, Steve Turi on trombone, Teddy Smith on bass, and Louis Nash on drums with the Hard Bop Grand Pop from Horace Silver's 1996 album Song for My Father. That album was nominated for a 1997 Grammy Award for Best Jazz Instrumental Performance and also for its originality for individual and group. Horace Silver died last week at the age of 85. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, June the 23rd, and if it sounds a little fuzzy, it is because we have huge rainstorms where I am. And sometimes it does wreak havoc with our internet service. Never mind what Comcast says, it isn't exactly foolproof. And so, but we sally forth. And in the spirit of good troopers, we make the best of a troubling and challenging situation. Secretary of State John Kerry literally descended on Baghdad today, arriving by helicopter from Amman, Jordan, for talks with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS, have steadily gained ground, blazing a brutal and murderous trail as they head toward Baghdad. Just yesterday, they captured three more towns along the Iraqi-Syrian border. Our guest, Gilbert Messier, co-founder and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, that's J-U-N-K-I-E, Post, says the crisis in Iraq should be seen as a shift, if you will, in Western imperialist strategy and policy, that of engineering failed states as the preferred method over regime change, which used to be the standard of destabilizing a nation, of external control and expansion of empire. And he joins us now. Thank you, Gilbert, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. I wish the weather were more cooperative here, but we're still able to do what we have to do.
I can hear you just fine, so it's okay.
Great. So Kerry is in Baghdad today, and of course, a compliant media, which is of course embedded with him, traveling with him as part of the PR effort, is suggesting that this is about the United States consulting in a critical situation where it is playing a major role, a lead role here in bringing peace and freedom and democracy to not just Iraq, but to the region as a whole. And, of course, we are not supposed to think at all that this has anything with the United States basically delivering the demand that Maliki step aside and that it gets to do what it wants to do. How do you read John Kerry's visit today?
Well, I read it that once again the U.S. is meddling in the affair of Iraq. And it's very easy to read. What he's doing is meeting a bunch of people to potentially pick a successor of al-Maliki, who is viewed as, well, besides the fact that the pretext is that he has applied a policy that is too pro-Shiite, but is also a lot too close to Iran. So that's kind of the situation here. And there, you know, John Kerry is meeting people in Iraq, including Amar al-Hakim, which is a very influential Shia cleric. And he has the reputation to be a kingmaker among the Shiites. And again, it's as you mentioned in your introduction, it is sort of trying to pretend to seek for a solution, but in reality, creating even a bigger mess. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go right ahead.
The reality on the ground is that President Obama has just committed, I believe it was June 18, to send 300 U.S. Quote-unquote military advisor, which really mean, in plain language, special forces, to help the Iraqi army, that is fading away. In the woodwork. It also means, and I'm sure that Secretary Kerry is traveling with plenty of those people, it probably means a large influx of former Blackwater mercenary back to Iraq, and I'm sure that Mr. Kerry with the in the green zone is working that out. Let's be blunt here. Let's not be sentimental. The concern of the United States of America and the West in Iraq is to make sure that ISIS doesn't take control of the oil. And you mentioned in your introduction, absolutely correctly, that yesterday they took four more towns, but they also are controlling now two major checkpoints, one from Iraq to Jordan and one from Iraq to Syria. And this should be a concern to everybody in the region.
You've been covering this region for quite some time, and in fact, years ago, about two, maybe even longer than that, maybe 3 years ago or so, you began to predict what has become the inevitable, that there would be, because of U.S. policy in that region, there would be this reaction, there would be a buildup of resistance, and it will be as brutal as we had, though most people would never imagine, but it is fueled by a great distaste, not only for, you know, the sectarian hard edges that had always existed, but because of Western interference in internal affairs. When you say that the United States has moved from a policy of regime change, which is it would typically, as we've seen time and again, it would typically just simply take over a country, it is now it has now moved for the more efficient or cost-efficient method that gives it also a certain amount of cushioning against any accusation that of direct involvement, and that is the concept of failed state. Could you discuss what that is?
Well, the concept of failed state is very simple. The model is, is Libya right now. The model is unfolding in Iraq. The model could be very, very soon Nigeria. What you do, you create a situation where you topple a strong leader like Gaddafi or Saddam. Not that I defend either of them. They were dictators, but they had a geopolitically... Geopolitics is about balance. But geopolitically, they kept the region balanced. Now, what interests the West in Libya is one thing, and one thing alone. It's not Libyan. It's oil. And that's the only thing they wanted. They got rid of Gaddafi. They have the oil. They secure the oil production, and that's all they care about. But I'll tell you, Utrecht, I made this comparison before on another radio show. If you see what's going on in the city of Detroit, Michigan, it is pretty much the same strategy. The concept that has to do with corporate imperialism, the concept of nation and the concept even of city and region has become a little bit obsolete. Detroit is in the path of getting completely gutted. It's like a fire sale. And that's what they're concerned about. They're not concerned, and the strong state and strong nationalist, like somebody like, of course, like Vladimir Putin in Russia, get in the way of that policy of dismantling everything and to be able to grab resources, to be able to put country in debt through the IMF or the World Bank, etc., etc. And that's why countries such as Iran and Syria are getting in the way of that sort of plan. And that plan is, of course, it's not a workable plan. You know, it's sort of kind of schizophrenic at best, and Machiavellian at worst. But it doesn't make any sense at all. I'll give you an example. Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, said on Sunday that the intelligence community failed to anticipate the Islamic extremist breakthrough. And she also mentioned that, as if it was just a discovery, that we are on the foot of a major Sunni-Shiite war. What is she talking about? That was created by, under the Reagan administration, fuel under the Bush senior administration, Clinton, Bush Jr., and so on. Acting surprised? I mean, what is this? I mean, do American people really buy this?
Well, so how then are we to read President Obama's withdrawal of troops? Is it that, in fact, he just wanted to bring an end to the war, a glorious end to the war, as a fulfillment of a campaign promise? Or is this, in fact, a confirmation that the administration knew that the failed state strategy, in fact, had worked and is continuing to work in Iraq quite well?
Yes, but you know, as I mentioned in my piece on News Junkie Post, you know, with the U.S. with the help of on the impulse of Saudi Arabia and Qatar have created is ISIS, and ISIS is out of the Pandora's box, and ISIS, they have their own agenda. They have decided to go in business. They have set up their own shop. They're going in business for their own. They have 2.3 billion. They're getting stronger and stronger by the day, and that's what they're doing. They're not controlling them anymore. They created them to topple Assad in Syria, but they've decided to move to Iraq, and you know, and do what they are doing.
Well, on this day today as well, you have President Assad confirming that he's going along with the other planks of the weapons de-escalation. But in other words, cleaning up the weapons problem that supposedly triggered the United States' involvement in attacking Syria, and basically saying to the world, we are abiding by the terms of the agreement. How do you read President Assad and therefore the role of Syria, if it will have a continuing role in the regional address of this question of what's unfolding in Iraq?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because what's unfolding in Iraq and the rise of ISIS in Iraq is really a blessing for Assad, because now there will not be any more push to topple Assad at all, because Assad will end up fighting, and this is the irony of it all, Assad will end up fighting against ISIS on the side of, American Navy SEAL, American drones, and Iranian Revolutionary Guard. It is just, if it wasn't an absolute nightmare for the Iraqis, the Kurds, the Syrians, if it wasn't a tragedy, it would be sort of comical, you know? There's so much inconsistency, so much stupidity involved, and there's also a character that needs to be mentioned, and people will understand more, your listeners. His name is Prince Bandar, and Prince Bandar is from Saudi Arabia. His nickname is Bandar Bush, because he's very close to the Bush family. He was the Saudi Arabia ambassador in Washington, D.C. for many, many years. And he concocted, he was the in charge of the intelligence in Saudi Arabia. He's the one, he was the architect to finance the jihadists, to put the jihadists together in Syria. That was his deal. And when it backfired about 6 months ago, he got the axe. So now he's out. But here you go. You know, Bandar Bush, great idea. Put this bunch of jihadists together, get them gone, anything they want. Help with, by the CIA, by the way, all along for like 3 years. And now you've got this sort of renegade jihadist army bombing the region. Lovely.
Well, we have three main forces from the West involved here. You have Britain, the United States, of course, and we also have France.
Yes.
Why is it that at this time, I mean, except we are hearing from Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of Britain, saying, well, you know, the invasion of Iraq cannot be blamed for the situation that exists now. And basically the heads of state are busy absolving themselves of any accountability at all for what's going on in Iraq. What do you think is going to be their role in this rapprochement that John Kerry is seeking in behalf of the Obama administration?
Well, what they want to do, they want a new man in Iraq. They want to pretend, because it's any new involvement in Iraq, official military involvement in Iraq, would be dreadful politically for Obama and the Democrats. Absolutely dreadful. Okay? Because it would show that the sort of official withdrawal from Iraq, which was only official, because there were a lot of mercenary remining behind, all the people working for the industrial military complex company like Halliburton, Dick Cheney company was still managing Iraq. All that stuff was still going on. But politically, in the context of the U.S. politics, which is sort of trivial and doesn't really matter, but it does matter for Americans, it would be a disaster for Obama. So he's going to make it look like, oh, we're not going to do it. He doesn't want, he said that he was not going to do airstrike. Hard to believe, I think what's going to happen, the reason why there's 300 special forces in there is to spot airstrike or drone strike, and that's what they're doing. So there will be drone strikes. But again, he doesn't want to help al-Maliki too much because they want to replace him. And what's going on right now in Iraq, on one side you've got ISIS, which are, well, mainly Iraqis, but also Syrian, and like a throwing legion of Islamists, including some European. And on the other side, al-Sadr, Cleric al-Sadr, is putting back the Mahdi army that fought the Americans. They already have 20,000 people in the Mahdi army that was comically renamed by al-Sadr the Peace Brigade because Mahdi army had a bad reputation. So everybody in the south of Iraq, in the Shiite part of Iraq, is armed, getting armed to the teeth. Just to give an idea, the price of a Kalashnikov in a week has increased by 50% in Baghdad. So people are, it's going to be a militia against a renegade army. It's really a nightmare. And the victim of all this are, of course, the Iraqis.
Well, at the same time, I've noticed a very interesting but subtle change of tone and attitude with respect to ISIS and the United States in particular, whereas it was, and the news media generally, describing this as a movement or as an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization or group, I think, unless I'm wrong, they have, at least in the last week or so, have come to understand that this is an army. This is an organized military group that is functioning as an army, and as such, it poses the question and poses a kind of embarrassment that under all of the sophisticated methods of spying and intelligence gathering and so forth, that the Iraqi government and its allies, its Western allies, somehow are stunned and surprised that they actually are facing an army. How did this happen?
Well, it happens because they had a job to do. The job was to topple Assad. But Assad turned out to be a lot tougher than in Syria, tougher than it seemed, and so they decided to go to Iraq. Now, you were mentioning about the al-Qaeda affiliation. ISIS has really nothing to do anymore with al-Qaeda. And ISIS is, their ambitions are a lot bigger than al-Qaeda. They have territorial ambition, okay? Their ambition is enormous. What they want to install a caliphate in most of the Arab world, ruled by Sharia law. They are in the process, if it works, of redesigning the map of the Middle East. They're already across from Syria and north of Iraq. Their next move might be, and I mentioned that in my article, up to Jordan. They're right at the border. So they should be all those kingdom, authoritarian regimes supported by the West, like Jordan, should be very concerned. very, very concerned. The plan, it's, you know, they've created Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the U.S. And U.K. and France have created a Frankenstein, and it's out of control.
Well, I had asked a question really to suggest that this is itself a cause for embarrassment, because if, in fact, there was a handle on this, if France and Britain and the United States, in fact, had a handle on the region, there is no way they would be stunned by now having to face an army as opposed to, you know what I mean? It takes a while to assemble an army. It takes sophistication and money and a number of resources to assemble an army. So although they had been maintaining that this is just a splinter group of Al-Qaeda, that in itself was a deception, a lie, to make people believe this is just a ragtag group of people. But what is clearly emerging is this is an army. This is
it
not
is.
Just a bunch of guys with rifles.
But
this is an army.
The connection between ISIS and Al Qaeda is a White House talking point that is being taken by the usual you know, media sycophant, New York Times and so on, and Washington Post, of saying, oh yeah, it's Al Qaeda affiliated, but they are not anymore. They haven't been in the past 2 years. As I said, and as you mentioned, they have territorial ambition that they are exercising as we speak. They want to start a state, you know, and it's not, you said, because even the name is sort of weird, you know, it's, some people call it, ISIS, which stand for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or other call it, ISIS. As ISIL, which stands for Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. And it's actually more the second that is accurate, because the ambition is very, very large. And everybody's getting scared. The thing is, Iran is not a real backup, the Shiite community in Iraq. They are likely, if needed, to move in.
We're talking with Gilbert Messier, co-founder and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and you could read the entries under his and the bylines of others at newsjunkiepost.com. And we're talking about the failed state strategy in Iraq and in the region. And we're talking about what would likely happen as the situation develops with today the visit of Secretary of State John, oh my gosh, I just
John Kerry,
so
that
much.
Is.
I didn't work on his name, so important is this. John Kerry basically visiting Baghdad and attempting to broker some kind of a deal. So in your view, what is likely to be the outcome? What would John Kerry be reporting to his boss at the end of the day today?
Well, I think he will report to his boss that, they need to pick another man. And this is going to be absolutely hilarious for anybody that remember the drum up to the war in Iraq in 2003. There is a name that is popping up in the short list of potential replacements for al-Maliki, and his name is Ahmed Chalabi. Ahmed Chalabi was the man that sold and the Bush administration, the Bush team was willing to buy all this nonsense about Saddam and weapon of mass destruction and all that stuff. Is closely affiliated to the neocons and even the CIA, Ahmed Chalabi again, might do a comeback. In Iraq, everybody thinks he's a crook, but he's on the short list, so we'll see. Al-Maliki is the man of Tehran, and that is one of the problems. The problem with Al-Maliki is also he's not liked by al-Sadr, the cleric, who is the leader of the Mahdi army. So Maliki, it's likely that Maliki will have to go. What Kerry is trying to do is to find a name that all the community in Iraq, Shiite, Sunni, and Kurd, would sort of agree on, so they can pretend to run some kind of election and put them in. That's what they're trying to do.
But that would still be operating in the old model. Is it not going to be operating within the old model of regime change as opposed to failed state? So which procedure would prevail?
It's sort of the old and the new combined. It's creating a nation, but a failed nation, potentially. Iraq was created to be very, very weak. It was the toppling of the strong man of the Middle East, Libya, Saddam, and the try against Assad. They are producing same result. You don't have a strong leadership. You have a community that are, you know, that have been butt against each other, mainly by the U.S., for decades. And now it's sort of a situation where you have a state, which, by the way, was created by the British in 1920s after the dismantlement of the Ottoman Empire in a very Machiavellic way as well, which to put Sunni, a minority, in charge in Iraq. Now, what could be a model for Iraq to make it less of a failed state would be to use the Lebanon model, which in Lebanon include as well a lot of Sunni, Shiite, and Christian. But they don't want to do that. What they want to have some kind of model that is not assertive, that is not too close to Iran, okay, and that doesn't create a huge mess to keep extracting the resource. So, It's schizophrenic because they're realizing that creating failed state, well, it doesn't really work, but they still like it anyway.
But just the same, even if they do go ahead with that model, the fact is a brand new reality exists in the region right now with ISIS. They are not changing. They're committed to one specific goal, and that is the establishment of an Islamist region, if you will, and that is not changing. So no matter what the United States does in accordance with its interests and the interests of its allies and the interests of a compliant internal government in Iraq, they still have to deal with the fact that the game has dramatically changed, and therefore, irrespective of what they do, there is this goal that not only has been identified by the ISIS army, but is actually being achieved by the ISIS army brutally and with a lot of deaths and upheaval, but they are proceeding according to their plan, which is inimical to the regime change plan. So that's my question. In any event, to what degree would Kerry, that is the United States and Britain and France, what will they be prepared to do if they go ahead with this cosmetic change of, you know, you take al-Maliki out and then we put somebody, some other new stooge in, but
look,
what happens with respect to the standing challenge of ISIS?
They have to start for once having a coherent policy. You cannot support a group of people in a country like Syria and pretend to oppose them in a country like Iraq. ISIS has been, they've been power bomb exploding in all of Iraq for 2 or 3 years, and it was barely covered by the U.S. media. People are acting like it's a big surprise. No, it's not a surprise. It's a surprise for them because they haven't been covering it. The notion of creating failed state, that is the end result. It might not even be an absolute sort of plan. It's more like they think that they can manage chaos, but obviously they can. They cannot manage chaos. Chaos will manage them. There hasn't been any consistency in the policy of the U.S. in the Middle East. Well, since the U.S. has taken some kind of leadership in world affairs since the end of World War II. You know, and fortunately, what could have been an enormous fiasco, which would have been an attack on Syria by the Obama administration and France in 2013, was avoided because of the assertive position taken by Vladimir Putin and China. So, it is. And by the way, I'm sure Vladimir Putin is quite enjoying himself with the situation in Iraq. It keeps the U.S. From another mess that they created in Ukraine. It is just, the meddling is just unbelievable.
Now, what about, I come back to Britain and France. The United States clearly has taken the lead. You just mentioned that, and that is true. What is going on with its age-old allies in that region, Britain and France?
Well, Britain, as I'm sure all your listeners remember, were directly involved in the Iraq, in the Bush war. It was a Bush-Tony Blair war. France wasn't involved at all. At the time, France was run by, the only true heir of General de Gaulle. His name was President Chirac, and President Chirac was an adamantly against the Iraqi folly. Now, that said, since then, a few elections later, the policy of France has completely changed. France has become completely, and even more so than the UK, if it's possible, aligned with the United States. Former President Sarkozy first was absolutely gung-ho on attacking Libya. He put back France into NATO. The new president, François Hollande, the so-called socialist president François Hollande, was extremely aggressive against Assad, and he was pushing for an attack. So what they're doing, and specifically in the case of France, with the policy in the rest of Africa and this sort of neo-colonialist policy that they have, which I discuss on your program in Mali and Central Africa, it's kind of like they their zone. It's what they're doing, but it's also completely counterproductive and creates problems. In the case of Centrafrique, it's creating problems between the Christian and the Muslim. In the case of Mali, it's creating problems between the people in the north, the Tuareg, and the people in the south. So it's never good to imperialism, whatever it's done, whatever pretext it is, it's never a good solution for the people that are on the receiving end.
What is your next article going to be, Gilbert?
Well, I think I'm probably going to keep tracking this. What's going on in Iraq, and the also sort of in the context of a diminution of the role of Qatar in the region compared to Saudi Arabia, because Qatar was the main backer of the Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi in Egypt. And that failed. They were also very much involved in the Syrian adventure of supporting the jihadists. So they sort of a semi power change in Qatar from father to son, but there's going to be a shift of that, and Qatar will have a smaller role compared to Saudi Arabia. So I think I'm going to kind of cover the story from that angle, and also very likely try to talk about something that I discuss in my article very briefly, that we didn't talk on air with you. Could that huge mess created around Israel be, in the long term, for the benefit of creating the greater Israel state? No, that is also one of the tracks here that need to be followed.
Well, I would love, when you are about to finish writing it, that is to say, I would like to have first dibs on your article when you're getting close to finishing, so that we could appreciate that, because, in fact, you do write about Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Israel, the role of these three countries. It's a huge, huge, huge mess that will have worldwide repercussions. It's already beginning to do that. But it is important that, you know, your point of view, which is so different from the point of view that we get, you know, from other media sources, it is refreshing, but it is also because you've been following the story for so many years, and you've been in that region for so many years, so you have a unique vantage point from observing the events unfolding in that area of the world. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Utris, for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And again, we will talk soon as the situation warrants.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye. Well, I want to switch gears a bit and talk about this method. And as you see, there are so many things here that pertain to our notions of what it means to be a citizen. I wanted to talk about this notion about what is it to be a citizen. And in connection with the unfolding situation in Iraq, I refer to this move by the president and members of Congress who make it at this time, you know, whenever the country is facing a war or facing some kind of military action that will involve national identity and national fervor and national approval. Of course, it's all cloaked in this business of democracy at home. since, of course, ostensibly the country is fighting for democracy abroad. So the way this is done is, for example, as it happened in 1998 with the passage of the Iraq Liberation Act, the president will seek, quote, permission. Of course, he's not seeking permission, but that's the technicality of it. The president is seeking permission from Congress, and Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, being the representatives of the people, will do the right thing and evaluate the validity of the president's request, and then would give the president permission to act in the nation's defense and nation's interests. But there's a curious thing about this process. And, for example, the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998 says, and it's specifically worded, I'm reading verbatim what it says it is about, an act to establish a program to support a transition to democracy in Iraq. Now, that sounds very, very noble, doesn't it? It sounds very, very noble, a very worthwhile pursuit. But Section 3, for example, where it says, sense of the Congress regarding United States policy toward Iraq. Okay? Sense of the Congress regarding United States policy toward Iraq. And this is what it says, and I quote verbatim. It should be the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq and to promote the emergence of a democratic government to replace that regime. Now, that is the stated purpose of the so-called legislation. And by that, one can say, well, then this legislation gives power and authority to people who are representing congressional districts and state seats in the Senate, the powers of nations at the United Nations. I mean, somebody with a congressional district has the power to decide that a government is to be removed and replaced. And this is law. This stands the smell test of constitutionality in the United States. And this is the kind of law that is routinely invoked by presidents to say, well, we observe the process. We observe the law. We are in keeping. We are a democratic society, for crying out loud. Look, the Senate and the House have both voted. And given that permission for us to go take out another government. And therefore it's illegal. What's your problem? Now, I have yet to hear a major series of questions around this. How could this possibly be constitutional and legal? How could this possibly be done without massive objection? How could this pass muster with the U.S. Supreme Court and any other independent entity that monitors the excesses of government? I read this again because it is so enormous. It's just one sentence. It should be the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq and to promote emergence of a democratic government to replace that regime. And with that one sentence came a whole bunch of obligations that the United States was willing to undertake to see to it that that is the policy and the end result. Commitment of billions of dollars to military and non-military aid and so forth. But the essential problem here is that this, which is on its face a blatant act of lawlessness, gets the you know, the perfume of democracy. It is there. You know, people could say, well, look, we had a process and we all voted. In fact, they voted unanimously. The Senate voted unanimously for this outrageous kind of conduct by the United States, under the guise that they were doing the right thing in the democratic way of taking out another government. Now, let's reverse this principle, this policy, as they say. What if another government said, you know, we just don't like the United States government. It is our policy to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or George Bush, to remove them from power and to promote the emergence of a democratic government that will replace that these administrations. What would the reaction be? Obviously, we know what the reaction would be. But we have to ask the question, why does this process stand without challenge? And how could it possibly be legitimate and legal and above board and in keeping with the so-called Constitution? And as we know, you could substitute any country, and this would pretty much be the reason and the rationale routinely given for U.S. involvement. And with U.S. involvement, we mean putting, as they say, boots on the ground, somebody's son or somebody's daughter on the battlefield. Because this is a policy. And a person with a mere congressional district or a Senate seat has more power, actually, than nations of the world in deciding these kinds of nefarious and completely undemocratic things. We have to start asking these questions. How could it possibly stand? And how did it stand? And how has it stood as policy, this completely illegal, unconstitutional, and undemocratic way, this reckless way of operating? I want to thank you for joining me today. We've come to the end of our program, and thank you so much for being troopers. We all are. Today, as I said, we had a little technological challenge with the weather. As I say, man proposes and God disposes. We got zapped by bad weather here and on my end today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. I wish you would drop me a line and let me know how these programs are resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Thanks so much for being with me today. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.